This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, my imagined incoherence. Tracy Fouad just published her first full-length collection, About Blank. In this collection, she embraces the fragment. She's like an archaeologist almost, carefully brushing the sand off some scrap of human culture, a phrase she plucked from the internet, or a bit of Kurdish, or a thought cut off midway. And altogether, these language artifacts layer into a world, her world, made up of all the places she's ever lived. And she's lived in plenty. First Minnesota, where she grew up, then Chicago, where she studied political science, after that, New York, where she got her MFA, and after that, Kurdistan, where her father is from. Recently, she moved again, this time to Berlin. I was just interested, why do you think you move?
I've thought about this a lot because I do find myself again and again in these new and strange situations, and I look at myself and realize I brought myself there intentionally. And there is something that I think I seek out in that discomfort or the newness. I've always found a certain level even of comfort in feeling a bit alienated, and that actually it's a more true way to see things rather than being in a comfortable situation where you, or I find that I stop to see things so clearly sometimes.
And can you maybe give me an example of like the last time that you moved, say, to Berlin? What were those things that shocked you again into that state of alienation?
Let me think. I moved to Berlin after living in Kurdistan for almost 2 years, and I eagerly started learning German. I was taking intensive classes for almost 4 hours a day for months and kind of ambitiously just thinking I would quickly learn the language. And how exhausting it is actually to be on the outside of a language that you want to be on the inside of, and having experienced that for 2 years in Kurdistan, and then just having to accept the fact that it happens very slowly to really learn a language. And it's been interesting how, yeah, spending some years learning Kurdish and then learning German, it's really changed my relationship with English. And sometimes I have this uncertainty about the word order in English, or I will say a very strange thing in English or forget how to say, how someone will ask me how to say something in English and I won't really be able to tell them.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering, I mean, because now when I listen to you, I'm not great at divining accents or where people are from or whatever, but you sound like you are German in your English.
You know, that's so funny, but I think I am somehow a bit of a chameleon, and I pick up accents around where I am, and people often tell me that I have a bit of an accent or that I don't sound like I'm from, where I'm from. This summer, I was waiting tables in far northern Minnesota where my parents live. And I asked if someone wanted coffee, and they asked me where I was from. And I said the Twin Cities, and they said, no, you're not. And I think I have this instinct to mirror the people who I'm around with. For example, when I was living in Kurdistan and mostly communicating with non-native English speakers, I started speaking only in the present tense. And it was so interesting
totally.
For me. Yeah.
That is so interesting to me, because I can also imagine that the opposite happens. Like, there's a writer, Garth Greenwell, who lived in Bulgaria for many years. And he said that his relationship to English changed in the sense that it became more private, like it was his little hideaway where he could retreat, in the evenings. And it made writing actually, in a sense, easier, because he had this really intimate connection to this well inside him. So do you feel like you have that too, or do you really just chameleon-like become where you are?
I just read both of Garth Greenwell's books and I loved them so much.
I devoured them.
And I think I especially, I was also teaching English in Kurdistan for 2 years, so I related to them so deeply, kind of confronting one's American identity while living out of the country. And I definitely do have that sense of English being my private home. And I read so much in Kurdistan. It was really a refuge for me. And while I was living there in a quite small town, an American organization donated 10,000 books to the university library. So I would sometimes go into this sort of big room in the university that was filled with books and unpack them and go through them and borrow some. And it was sort of hard to get books. So when you did then find a book, and in that shipment of books, most of which were sort of useless, outdated medical textbooks, which I found actually quite unethical to send abroad. I found some real treasures, a book by a professor of mine, A. Van Jordan, and some books of poetry. You sort of wondered, how did they get here? And a book by Rachel Cusk. And I wrote much, not all, but much of my book of poetry while I was living in Kurdistan, having this new and very different relationship to language, to space, to my identity, to English and to Kurdish.
Yeah. And you said earlier that, you know, in Kurdistan, you were really confronted with your American identity. And I'm so interested in that because, you know, your dad is from Kurdistan. That's where he grew up, Iraqi Kurdistan. And so I'm wondering, like, how familiar is it to you, or how foreign? Like, do you have tourist eyes, you know, these kind of eyes that are primed to see charm and authenticity everywhere? Or do you know it too well, in a sense, to do that?
It's a really interesting question, and I've thought about it a lot because it's a complicated story, my relationship to Kurdistan. And it actually starts with my grandfather. My Kurdish grandfather studied in the U.S. in the 50s and married an American woman. And my father was born actually in Minnesota, but then they moved to Baghdad and actually to Abu Ghraib before it was Abu Ghraib. Yeah. Where my father spent his very early years, and then they moved around a lot. And then my father was in the U.S. in 1974 visiting his American grandparents, and they were packed and ready to move back to, they were living in Libya at the time. Uh-huh. And I don't know how much is myth, but the story is that the teenage friend of my father rode across the lake to say the king had been deposed and that Gaddafi had actually taken control of Libya and had closed the borders. And sure enough, my grandmother turned on the radio. This was true. And that is the story of how my father at 14 then stayed in the U.S.
Oh, so he didn't even grow up in Kurdistan, like he grew up in Iraq proper.
They lived in Abu Ghraib only maybe until my father was four. And then they were living in Sulaymaniyya, which is where my grandfather's from, maybe until my father was 12 or so. So there were a lot of years spent in Sulaymaniyya, in the Kurdish part of Iraq, or the Iraqi part of Kurdistan, the part of Kurdistan that falls in Iraq.
Right.
It's very complicated. But after he left in 1974, he didn't go back until we all went together as a family. And I think this was in 2009. I was 19 or 20. And it was the first time my father had been back since he was a child. And at that time, I went purely with, touristic eyes of, I think I had known mostly about Iraq through the lens of being an American watching the war, and I'd heard some stories about my father's childhood there, but we didn't really have pictures. It wasn't something that was really in my consciousness of something that had anything to do with me until I went there. But that summer, my brothers and parents went home, but I stayed there for the rest of the summer. And then I came back the next summer. I became very close with my grandfather and with my cousins. And I think that's really when it started for me, when I suddenly realized that there was this part of me that, yeah, I hadn't really known existed.
Do you feel like it explained something about yourself that you hadn't understood before?
I mean, maybe. I was aware that I was Kurdish from a young age, but there was no one really to talk to that about, because I do think I really, in a way that was quite intended, was raised as a white American. You know, my parents were quite intentional about giving me and both of my brothers very American names, because they knew we already had a foreign last name. So I think a lot of my story is a story of my father's assimilation and then the next generation sort of uncovering that history and finding out your relationship to it.
Yeah. There's a poem that I was wondering if you could read. It's on page 86 of your book About Blank. It doesn't have a title, and it's the one that starts, "Banned from Shipping to Iraq." And I was wondering if you can introduce it somehow, whatever you want to say about it, if you remember when you wrote it, if you remember what the kernel was, or anything that you want to say to introduce it before you read.
So I think I wrote this soon after I moved to Kurdistan, when I was feeling almost that there must be something in my physical material body that resonated when I was there, almost like, yeah, this like earth body communication that I couldn't explain. And I had done at the time a lot of research also about Saddam Hussein, this figure who I had a like years-long obsession with, in part because he wrote poetry and some novels, and he's just one of these sorts of more evil than evil figures, especially for Kurds, because he was responsible for the killing of so many Kurds. So this poem was written in that time. Mm-hmm. Banned from shipping to Iraq. Vitamins, herbs, knives, Viagra, and communistic materials. Still, I Google, "Can you Amazon to Kurdistan?" While in captivity, Saddam was plied by family-sized bags of Doritos for which he had a penchant. What about experimental theocracy? When the world was more ancient, perhaps it was easier to hear the music of flowers. What else has dimmed in our heated efficiency? I'm looking to come to a compromise with my objects so we stop doing harm to one another. But the stones here hum between wake and sleep, a soft little ballad for home. Beneath my skin, I am certain there is other fabric, that I am clothes all the way to the core. Someone is taking off my outermost. Someone is mining the ancient veins. Was there ever a country called Kurdistan?
Thank you. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about the tension between when the world was more ancient, perhaps it was easier to hear the music of flowers. And then you also write a little later, beneath my skin, I'm certain there's utter fabric, that I'm close all the way to the core. Mm-hmm. Like, can you talk a little bit about like these tensions between the supposedly ancient and authentic and like society? And can you Amazon to Kurdistan? Mm-hmm. You know, am I close all the way down?
Well, I mean, I think it's impossible not to romanticize Kurdistan, because this is the cradle of civilization. And there are people in Kurdistan still living the way the earliest humans lived, or of course, you know, not so different, but with smartphones.
Right.
But still tending sheep and a semi-nomadic life, moving up to the mountains in the summer for the sheep to graze. And this is where sheep were domesticated, more or less, and where crops were domesticated, more or less. So there's really the sense of being in contact with the ancient. And I was living in a town called Rania, which is about 2 hours north of Sulaymaniyah, not so far from the Iraq-Iran border. So it's right in the foothills of the Zagros Mountains. And there are many, many archaeological sites there. So there's a plain, and then there will be mounds of dirt. And these mounds of dirt are what's left of very ancient 3,000, 4,000, 5,000-year-old civilizations. You know, it's just in the dirt, someone pulls out this piece of glass, and it's a 5,000-year-old bracelet.
Wow.
And so you can't help but feeling in contact with something very ancient. And Kurds themselves, although most of them don't live in villages anymore, the romanticized village life is very deeply a part of Kurdish identity. Mm-hmm. So I'm so drawn to that. And then at the same time, you know, you might still want something that you can't find there, and how can I get this? So you're always already embedded in this society that you've been born into, even if you're yearning for or longing for a past that never really existed, that's mm-hmm. always being constructed by us to fit our imagination's needs.
Totally.
And of course, I mean, in Kurdistan, it's like anywhere else. Everyone is on Instagram and listening to Pitbull right. at the gym doing Zumba. I mean, but yes, this idea of going back to the roots is a part of Kurdish identity too.
Aha, of course. I'm also interested in the language and how that made you feel like it was old or not, because Kurdish, as I understand it, is an Indo-European language, but it's from the Indo part rather than from the European mm-hmm. part of the tree. So it's like closer to Persian than to, you know, English or Italian or Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, when you have a common ancestor that is so bloody old, do you feel like you can kind of sense that somewhere? Do you feel like you're in touch with like an older part of your language brain or something?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can never be sure if that's just my romantic poet self feeling yeah. that the language is very ancient. And of course, modern Kurdish, like all languages, has evolved, but it is closer to this more ancient language, I think. It hasn't yeah. traveled as far, certainly, and there are a lot of fascinating things about the Kurdish language, which is just endlessly fun to learn, especially because it was very self-directed learning. I never took a class. It was very much exploring. Mm-hmm. I found some informal teachers, but this was a process of discovery and discovering yeah. how different words connected. Kurdish is a very embodied language. It's very poetic. The vocabulary sometimes feels quite simple and limited, but in this way that then words are used in 15 different ways depending on the context, and the expressions are very poetic. So there's this Kurdish word that had many different definitions in the dictionary, band, and it means prison, dungeon, joint, spell, but my cousin was telling me that it has at least 18 different other meanings, most of which are maybe archaic or out of use or only used in poetry. But an expression for child is bandi dil, which means like tied to my heart.
Oh,
and so that is a phrase for child.
That is just a normal phrase for child. That's like how you say child.
Mm-hmm,
wow.
Mm-hmm. And you hear very often in Kurdish, like in a Kurdish family, you hear korbanet bim, which means like, I sacrifice myself for you. Or there's this very poetic expressiveness that's always in the body. To mm-hmm. say I am happy, you say my heart is khosh, like dilim khosha, like my heart is good right now, my heart is nice right now. Or to talk about your mood, you talk about your weather.
Wow, so, seriously, that is so beautiful. When you when you talk about your mood, like I'm in a bad mood, you say it's bad weather, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And you ask someone, how is your weather?
Wow.
So I could just keep learning the language forever. It's just mm-hmm. exquisitely beautiful.
Yeah. Well, what I'm also interested in is the new, like the language that is not at all ancient and in touch with our bodies and, you know, but the exact opposite, the language that is internet-based and kind of cerebral, you know. And I'm so interested in how you manage to see that language so clearly. Maybe we can just start with a poem. I was thinking maybe that poem on page 41, 4 3/4 stars, mm-hmm. which is written in the form of a Yelp review.
Okay, yeah.
So can you tell me, how do you actually see the language we use and mine it for things that you can incorporate in your poems?
Well, these are all real Yelp and Google reviews of a Kurdish restaurant my aunt opened in the 90s when I was a kid. This was like a main point of connection to Kurdistan when I was growing up. I loved going there. We went there all the time. So the funny thing is, on the menu of this restaurant, there is a story about how the restaurant came to be. And it's a story about my family, with a picture of my father as a very small child with his grandparents, Hepzehan and Abdul Karim, in traditional Kurdish dress. And so the origin story is hilarious because my aunt is a very funny person and a writer, and she wrote the origin story. And it has the word prowess, as in the Kurds were known for their sexual prowess. And so when I was like 8, I was like, must know what prowess means, because it's next to the word sexual. And I remember, like, in my elementary school library, climbing up on the... There was like a step stool in front of the big, big, big dictionary, and looking up the word prowess and like trying to figure out what that meant.
That's amazing. Were you a little deflated when you figured out what it meant?
Well, I still couldn't really, you know, I was really young, like 8, so I couldn't quite figure it out together. Like, I didn't know what sexual prowess could mean. But the origin story is a bit that my grandfather heard about how beautiful the women were in Minnesota, how strong and blonde they were, and went there. And so that's also very strange to read about your family on a public menu of a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's still on the menu, too. So I'll read the poem. 4 3/4 stars. Rare find. As close as one can get. Ethnic, legit. Not overly spicy, not overly overwhelming. Just enough to give a hint. On my bland palate, the origin story's hilarious. Unfortunately, still too exotic. I've been living under a rock for so long. I think the mom cooks in the back, and the son, in his tight muscle shirt, waits the restaurant. A twinkle in his eye hinted he knew I was about to be delighted. They are the friendliest ever. They are like family now. So I love this restaurant so much, and it's so personal to me because I grew up going there.
Yeah.
And it's very strange to go online and see like that other people love it, but what Minnesotans write about a Kurdish restaurant is really funny, unsurprisingly. And so I was spending hours and hours and hours like scrolling through, reading all 500 reviews and copying all the language. And so this poem was, maybe at one point there were 5 or 10 pages of reviews, and then I kind of cut it down and cut it down and cut it down.
Right.
But I love to read reviews online. I think they're just so interesting. They're so telling about who we are as people.
It's an amazing genre. It never gets old,
you know? Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm so interested in the actual language. I mean, I do edit it sometimes, mm-hmm. but I feel like it's such a powerful document when you take a sentence that already exists, and then just using juxtaposition and line breaks, you can really reveal things about it. So bring out the language underneath the language that's already there.
You teach at the Berlin Writers Workshop right now. And actually, I got your name through one of your students, Anne-Sophie Balzer. And she had a question for you. She wanted to know what you learn yourself from teaching.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was a bit uncertain about when I was approaching teaching this poetry workshop was, would I be able to articulate myself? Because I often feel very frustrated when I'm trying to express an idea and I can see the idea swirling in my head, but to actually extrude it into words feels sometimes like an impossible task. And I think that's why I'm a writer. So sometimes it feels so hard to express something in writing, but I've become more and more comfortable with this idea that sometimes complexity or confusion or things that aren't super clear, that also has a merit. It's not necessarily of less value, and that actually things that are expressed so clearly are not necessarily more important or better. So like learning to be comfortable too with a bit of like a level of incoherence.
I want to connect that to an essay that I know you love and that you asked your students to read at the beginning of the workshop you just gave. Mm. And it's an essay by the American poet Reginald Shepherd. Mm. And it's titled Why I Write. And it begins, I write because I would like to live forever. And he's talking about, you know, this thing that I think a lot of writers have talked about, you know, the wanting to be immortal. But he also talks about this other kind of death, you know, not the death that comes at the end of life, but the death that stalks our life, you know, that makes every moment sink into oblivion every single day again. Mm-hmm. And he writes, my aim is to rescue some portion of the drowned and drowning, including always myself. And I'm wondering, yeah, if you can tell me about this essay, how it resonates with you, and why do you write?
I first read this essay in a workshop with Robin Coste Lewis in Provincetown. Mm. And it just really shook me because I had been feeling what he describes in this essay my whole life, but never having seen the words put to it. And it felt like it opened up a new space for me to write into that. And I think there's a line too that I write because I'm offended by my own death and the death of my mother, and this constant threat of oblivion. And I do think that this was imprinted on me in a very specific way from a young age. When I was 13, turning 14 was when the U.S. invaded Iraq, and I was a teenager, and I watched it on TV, and I watched bombs exploded in Baghdad, where I'd known my father had grown up, in this very childlike, quite naive sense of, like, why am I here and not there? And one of my early encounters with my Kurdish identity was Googling Kurdistan or something. It was before Google, so it must have been Ask Jeeves or something. And
yeah.
And finding, pictures from the genocide in Halabja that were probably on some sort of gore website. I think I had from an early age the sense of this other possibility of this other life that I could have lived, or this constant threat of oblivion that was never too far away, although it was and has been always at a distance, and yet sometimes that distance and the threat of the distance collapsing is something that's never felt too far away. And it's a big question of why I write, and I would love to have a more coherent answer, but it is even, I mean, incoherence is for me, I think, a big fear. When I was a very small child, I was in speech therapy from until I was 10. So I myself don't know how severe my speech impediment was, but I have been told that as a very small child, no one could understand me except my mother. And I don't really remember what that experience was like, but I can imagine that this very human desire to be understood is so powerful, and what my very, very, very small self who was just learning to speak must have felt to not be understood. And so I think I write, I mean, language is so tenuous. It's such a risk anytime you say anything, if it will be received, especially if it's not your native language, which I think is some of the why I'm so drawn then to learn new languages.
Is it like that you mean that at least when you learn a new language, the threat of incoherence is no longer a threat? Like you're going to be incoherent for a long time, you know, like you don't have to feel bad about it. That just comes with the territory, you know? Like, does it free you up in a sense to seek out incoherence rather than shrink from it?
Yeah, actually, maybe it does. I think there's this total thrill at the very early stages of learning a new language, where the joy of getting to babble and for someone to meet that with any sort of recognition.
Yeah.
I remember a few months ago, and it had been a quite strict lockdown for a long time, and I had very little contact with other people, but I went into a bookstore and I said in German, like, ja, ich habe etwas bestellt. And I said, I have ordered something, but I had the sense that I was totally unsure if I was saying the right thing. And it was such a shock then to be received. I think, maybe it is this recreation of that earliest experience one has with language of speaking and being received.
Absolutely. And I also feel sometimes like that thing that you just describe, it can almost feel like you're going back to the incantational power of language, you know, that you can like cast a spell, like you can say like a bunch of syllables and a person will react in a certain way, you know, like that is wild, right?
It's totally wild. And I think being close to the wildness of it, you have to leave your mother tongue to see it again.
And so since you just said, you know, in order to see your mother tongue, you have to leave it. Do you feel that that is a sort of parallel to the memento mori that Reginald Shepherd writes about, you know, that knowing that we'll die is what will make us see the days we've got?
Yeah, I've always thought that people don't think or talk about death enough. I mean, I just think it's in Western societies, it's something that's so marginalized and pushed to the side. And I think insisting on thinking about it, I think it's a healthy way to live. It's the reason why I love to fly in airplanes.
Wait, explain that.
Oh, I love flying in airplanes because I always, come to terms with my own mortality. I mean, I'm actually very afraid of flying, or I've become very afraid of flying as I'm older, but I'm not nervous about it until I'm in the plane, and then I'm absolutely terrified, but in this way where I'm really forced to think about it, like the absolute tenuousness of being a body. I had all these fantasies when I was a child of, like, if the plane crashed, I would write a letter and then put it in a bag and then put it in my mouth. Like, this desire to be, saved from the absolute void of incoherence, of death, of non-existence.
Tracy Fouad is the author of two chapbooks, Dad, 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 an incredibly funny art book about her father, or fathers, or daddiness, published in 2019, and Pith, winner of the Gloria Anzaldúa Prize, published in 2020. Her upcoming debut collection is titled About Blank, and was selected by Claudia Rankine for the Donald Hall Prize, and was a finalist for the National Poetry Series. She's received fellowships from Hedgebrook, the Barbara Deming Fund for Women, Squaw Valley Community of Writers, and the Vermont Studio Center. She currently lives in Berlin with her partner and teaches at the Berlin Writers Workshop, but soon she'll be moving again, this time to Provincetown, where she'll be a poetry fellow at the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center. To find out more, check out the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.